Today is November 3rd, and I'm at the home of Mr. Nelson Brickham. And Mr. Brickham, maybe you could tell me how you got to be involved with the CIA, how you came to join the agency. I believe it was in 1949, after you had graduated.
You mentioned the thing about personality imprinting itself on programs and so on. Or activities that actually I lined myself up with the CIA the year before I graduated.
Were you asked
to join? It's hard to say exactly how it all came about. I've always, since I was a boy, been interested in intelligence, guerrilla warfare, and international politics, and so on. Probably started in the concern I had just as a kid with the rise of Hitler and the whole business of the 30s and the disastrous course that the so-called Western allies were pursuing at that time. At the same time, I was a double-barreled person in a sense. Along with those interests, I was interested also in mathematics and physical sciences. When I actually entered university, Yale in 1946, I had already completed a year of science at the Glendale Junior College in Glendale, California, which was accepted by the Yale program. So I entered second year science in mathematical physics at Yale. And within a year's time, a number of things came together. Once again, going back to my experience with international politics and then with the end of the war with the atomic bomb in 1945, I made a decision that what the world needed really was not less science and technology, and more in the way of understanding and wisdom in international politics, international relationship. I felt at that time that unless this genie was somehow pushed back in the bottle, that in time the nuclear thing would overwhelm the world.
Was this because of your understanding in mathematical physics, you understood the principles of nuclear energy,
and were following
it closely and could see how proliferation
they were, might they're result, related, so. And also the fact with my long-standing interest in international politics and history and so on, mm-hmm. I was also aware of the many misadventures in human history and in politics in terms of arms control and that kind of thing. I came to a decision in my own mind that the situation was fairly desperate. So I switched over to, I switched my majors, my major at Yale to international politics, and thinking that someday I was going to have a job. I thought that probably the Russian language would be a good thing to have. And so I switched from German, which was my science language, to Russian, which fortunately at Yale was being taught under the new, at that time, intensive language training program approach. Under Bill Cornyn, who was one of the founders with Leonard Bloomfield, I think his name was, of the Army's intensive language training programs during the war.
And they moved on to Yale after the war.
Bill Cornyn came to Yale and set up a Russian language department at the university, which I found, I cannot tolerate classical methods of language training. They just don't work with me. what the intensive approaches with tapes and so forth and so on do. And I enjoyed this very much and made out quite fairly well.
I suppose that would include being in a room listening to tapes,
yes,
and responding,
yes,
to that kind of,
yes,
phone.
Except we didn't have tapes in those days. We had little wax discs.
Okay.
So the time came. I got married while I was in the Army, and by 1947 had two children. And once again, this question of making a living after university became pressing. And so, in terms of not my new interests, but my new decisions in terms of career and so on, I focused on the new intelligence services that were being constructed after the war, abolition of the OSS, but then the putting back together of a Central Intelligence Group, and then legislation leading to a Central Intelligence Agency, I think in 1947.
Mm-hmm.
So, to make a long story short, in summer of 1948, 6 months before my graduation, I came down to Washington from New Haven, simply to explore job opportunities. I went through the whole Foreign Service drill and with applications and examination papers and so forth for that. I went over to the Pentagon to talk to the air intelligence people. I had been in Air Corps during the war. And to the Library of Congress, where there was intelligence organizations being over there.
Library of Congress?
Yes. It was under Air Force contract. Translation work and some kind of work. All unclassified.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the CIA. And I met some people in, came down with some letters from professors at Yale, met some people in the Department of State who sent me to certain people in the CIA. I had my interviews. I spent 3 days in the agency, at the end of which time I was brought back and interviewed for my experiences with a fairly senior guy from the agency.
Can you say who?
It was Bill Tidwell. Listening to my experiences and his decision that I had been treated very well at the agency, and there was nothing to be done, but he did stick with it. So I graduated the following February. As I mentioned earlier, Magna Cum Laude. Just throw that in.
Something to be proud of.
Well, I didn't make Phi Beta, which upset me at the time. But this was next best. And came down to Washington, came to work, first of all, in translating Russian material.
For the CIA?
For the CIA.
Okay.
But then, as soon as my clearance was completed, I went to work in the old Office of Reports and Estimates, which was the analytical reporting and estimating office of the CIA prior to the great reorganization, which shaped the agency for the next 30 years or so, 25 years, by Beale Smith in 1950. In the Office of Reports and Estimates, I went to work first of all as a Czechoslovak desk officer, and several years, at the time of the Korean War, transferred over to the Special Intelligence Unit, which handled information on both source bases on USSR political and foreign policy.
All source intelligence.
All source.
Meaning?
Well, special intelligence. You know, special intelligence, communications intelligence.
I know what the military means by special security. Yeah. Not the same thing.
Well, no. I mean, this is all in this paper. So,
okay.
Special intelligence is communications.
Okay.
Or other esoteric type of sources.
Okay.
By and large, communications intelligence.
What could something else be besides, what could special intelligence be apart from communications that would be, esoteric?
Well, there are a variety of things. You have certain audio techniques.
Okay.
For example, there was a TV action story just in the past week's time.
Okay.
In which a laser beam is reflected off of a window pane in order to pick up.
I think I saw it. Yeah, and the voice vibrates on the window, so it magnifies. Okay.
This was, don't
okay.
take your notes off the record. This was developed by us about 20 years ago.
Yeah, okay. I think that if the people who write the TV scripts know that, it's probably common knowledge.
Yeah. I mean, it probably is, but
yeah.
Casey's new policy of prosecuting people for things that they published already in the public domain, mm-hmm. which is unconstitutional, which in time will be thrown
out. Well, any time that you feel that you're getting into murky water, just say so, and I'll flip that right off.
Well, it's on the tape. It doesn't have to be off.
If you want to take it off,
no.
But
I'll just say off the record or back on the record. I said off the record, but back on
okay.
the record. But there are other types of esoteric, things can be special types of communication. Communication intelligence is highly complex.
Well, in your job as doing in special intelligence, you become aware of all these
not
things.
All highly complex. That's what I'm coming to.
Okay.
Special intelligence is a highly compartmented area.
Okay.
Or at least it was in those days. It's far less so today. As an example, mm-hmm. In cryptographic successes against the, let's as an example, hypothetical, cryptographic successes against Vatican diplomatic ciphers. No one of a Catholic background would ever be permitted to have access to that material.
Okay.
If there were cryptographic success against the Israelis, no person with a Jewish background would be permitted to have access. It's that tightly compartmented.
Okay.
It was. 1970 it was. I guess Jack Anderson published how we were intercepting the microwave communications between the of the Politburo mobile telephone wires in Moscow.
Yeah.
And in the an enormously valuable source which we lost as a result of Jack Anderson's.
Okay. Well, this is one of the reasons I feel more comfortable dealing with history 15 years ago.
Yeah, well, so do I.
One of the things I don't want to do is
get into some modern mess.
I feel a little more comfortable.
Do you want to?
Might as well get us whatever you say on tape.
As I said before all the tape was off, Casey was a cowboy. He was this young, 32-year-old, I think, Wall Street lawyer in the war, at wartime, and went in the OSS, wound up as the chief of European operations for the OSS in London. And it was under his direction and supervision that the OSS undertook what all of the Allied services, including the Brits, believed to be impossible. And that was agent penetration of the German heartland. And so Casey went ahead with it, or his branch offices did, and succeeded. It was a successful operation, or program, I should call it. Casey's attitudes ever since after the war, he left the service, just like Alan Dulles did in the First World War, and stayed, made his money and so forth in private business. Fair enough. Although I gather that perhaps not quite as ethically as Alan Dulles did in his Wall Street adventures. In any event, Casey, I think, brought to the CIA, when he was appointed director by Reagan, attitudes which were pervasive in the OSS and during the wartime excitement.
Okay.
And doesn't place a terribly great premium on experience, is interested in enthusiasm and innovation, and that kind of thing.
Which is maybe a little bit dated, I suppose.
I think in this day and age it is dated, but nonetheless, certain virtues there which were lost through the bureaucracies of the post-war period. So that he certainly has brought to the agency, he's brought several things to the agency. One, an almost unlimited budget, from the administration, none of our previous directors have ever had the luxury of having.
Do you think that because of his close ties to Reagan?
Oh, no question.
Yeah.
Plus the general attitude of the Reagan administration.
Okay.
in the anti-communist crusade. I have to describe the Reagan policies toward Russia as dominated by the capitalist mentalities of the early 20s.
Okay.
The Red Menace.
Yeah.
These people, it's incredible. But
I always think that the policy makers must be thinking differently and just publicizing their views in that way. That really behind the scenes
they must be
more sophisticated.
No, they aren't. They're incredible. I didn't believe that people like this still existed.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, on the outside, I look in and I think, well, they must be appealing to the public by going back to those old views, simplistic views, but inside the inner circle, they must actually think differently and just have their information managers present the thinking in that way.
No, not really. They believe. Okay. They are true believers. And it's true that they present it to the public also in these simplistic terms because they know that works.
Okay.
And the events that we've seen in recent years, all of these, which are a reflection or a reaction to the psychic trauma of the country following Vietnam.
Vietnam, yeah.
Very similar, although on a far more modest scale, obviously, but similar in character. Mm-hmm. This is where it's dangerous. Similar in character to the frustration and bitterness of the German nation after defeating
the
First World War.
The stab in the back.
Including stab in the back.
Yeah.
So that, and it's the same kind of people that finance Reagan as finance Hitler.
Okay, well let's...
And let's not get too much further into that.
Let's go back to during Korea and your experience there.
Yeah, and so... So anyway, Casey enjoyed the support of the administration financially, enjoyed the support of the cowboys that wanted to give the agency a far greater latitude of action and get back into activities which, for one reason or another, phased out over the years.
Okay.
And that's where he's at.
Okay.
His great mistake was bringing somebody like that Hubel fellow, I think his name was.
Max Hugel.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. I was living in New Hampshire at that time.
Director of operations, terrible mistake. Okay, now, you wanted to get back...
To Korea, back to your chronology.
Oh, yeah, okay. So then it was after Korea, which the agency miscalled along with everybody else in the ad in respect to the Chinese communist intervention, which resulted in the dismissal of Admiral Hillenkoetter as director and the bringing in of Walter Bale Smith, the director, who shook the agency up from top to bottom, reorganized it completely. And out of the old Office of Reports and Estimates, he created three offices: the Office of Current Intelligence, of which I became a member, the Office of Reports, Office of Research and Reports, economic, focused entirely on economic research, primarily on the Soviet bloc and Communist China. And the Office of National Estimates. And Bill Langer, was that his name? Was brought back from New England to head up the Office of National Estimates.
Are you in Washington all this time?
In Washington all this time.
Okay.
Okay.
And this is before the Langley headquarters, isn't it?
Oh yes, we're down in we're down in the old Temple Q's down in down in 26th and East.
Foggy Bottom.
Foggy Bottom.
Okay.
Down there, yeah. So then, I had the very good fortune of getting involved with one other person in depth research on Soviet political process at the time of the so-called Doctor's Plot in Moscow and following March, the illness and death of Stalin. This led to a group of papers, and this was known as the Caesar Project. Concerned itself with succession processes in the USSR. And we produced a series of papers which were shown to shown around the highest levels of the government and received the approbation of George Kennan, and they were sent to Moscow for investor polls, responses, and so on.
Who was the other person that you got involved with?
His name was, and it would have to be off the record. I don't care about that. Off the record, unless and until he cleared permission to use his name, James Hanrahan, who is only recently retired from the agency and is still on contract too, back on record. Okay. The Caesar Project was also so impressed the Brits that Hanrahan and I were invited, this other person and I were invited to London as guests of the MI6 headquarters, where we spent about 6 weeks consulting with the British. This in November 1954. And I was so enamored of our European visit because Jim and I went on to German station. As well as the various British intelligence facilities, that on coming back, I decided that I wanted to transfer over to the so-called DDP, Deputy Director for Plans, as opposed to the DDI, of which OCI was a part, Deputy Director for Intelligence, which I accomplished in September 1954.
Is this during the time of the Berlin Tunnel?
In these years, in these various years, due to our special position, Hanrahan and I both had different opportunities for exposure to the upper levels of U.S. government. We were both at different times seconded to the DCI's office for temporary duty. And I was given the privilege at one time for spend 3 months on a research project in the other half of the agency, the operations director, which was unheard of in those days.
You mean the DDI was doing a study on the DDP?
Yes.
Which was sort of, I suppose, could have aroused some internecine strife.
Substantial.
Okay.
Fascinating experience.
Which I suppose also gave you an overview.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So in September 55, I transferred over to the Soviet division. Into American-based operations.
So you're back. You were in Washington.
In Washington.
Okay.
And I'm still in Washington until some years later.
Okay.
In 1958, I became chief. Operations Research Branch of the Soviet Division, which concerned itself with planning of clandestine operations, both black and white.
Can you give me examples?
Into the USSR. One such operation was a emplacement, involved the emplacement of long-range photographic and signet equipment near the Soviet base in Chertom.
Want to give me a spelling?
T-Y-U-R-A-T-A-N. New word, T-A-N. The Soviet nuclear weapons test site.
Were you around during the U2 Gary Powers flap?
Yeah.
Were you people the ones who were doing that one?
We didn't run that. That was another branch of special intelligence, a pilot compartment. But we were introduced to it. For example, I had the U2 clearance, I saw the U2 photography and so on, because I needed it in terms of planning these operations.
You probably used their photography to help do what you did. Okay.
Their photography. This mission never came off. It was to be staged from Iran and placement in the desert. Low-flying aircraft, the whole bit. That would be one example. Other examples are the preparation of false documents and legends for black agents, illegal agents. Research papers on specific geographic targets and analysis. Out of all this, the Soviets sent up Sputnik, scared everybody, and we did. I was put in charge of a massive research project to develop
targets, collection targets against the Soviet missile program. The actual genesis of that project was more amusing than that. What happened was that everybody was so exercised that two representatives of the DDI, one from the Office of Research and Reports, the other from the Office of Scientific Intelligence, which handled nuclear questions and missile questions, were assigned to the SR division to, quote, assist them. From the SR standpoint, these fellows were purely bad news. The division chief was tearing his hair as to what to do with them and assigned them to me to keep them out of trouble, keep them busy, keep them out of trouble, and keep them out of their way.